particularly youth.
Right. You know, it's unfortunate that, you know, the first response is to just lock people up and throw them away when, you know, if you really just take the time to invest in people, like people aren't disposable. Like, we're all capable of redemption. We're all capable of being helped and being our better selves. Like, everyone deserves a second chance.
On that note, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Santoya Brown Long, sex trafficking survivor, sentenced to life in prison after being convicted of first-degree murder for shooting her rapist as a teenager. A years-long campaign helped her to win her freedom. She was granted clemency in January, released in August. Her memoir, Free Santoya, My Search for Redemption in the American Prison System. It was published this week. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's time for the annual WHFR Record Show. One day only, Saturday, October 19th, on the campus of Henry Ford College, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. $5 early admission at 9 a.m. More than 25 vendors all under one roof. Hundreds of CDs, vinyl records, cassette tapes, videos, and memorabilia. Pick up some WHFR swag. Prize giveaways every hour. Shop early. Stay late. But if you miss it, you'll have to wait until next year. That's why it's called Annual, the WHFR Annual Record Show. One day only, Saturday, October 19th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Do not miss it. Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Good afternoon and welcome to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. Susan McGraw has the day off, and I pretty much do too, as today we welcome in the students from Henry Ford College's Mirror News newspaper for an extended hour of Mirror News Now, looking into some stories which appeared in the latest print edition of the Mirror News here at Henry Ford College. We do hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the October edition of Mirror News Now. Our first story is from Olivia Grantham, who attended Henry Ford College's first climate forum, where faculty, staff, and students sought to raise awareness of climate change and the need to act.
On September 20th, Henry Ford College faculty, staff, and students held a climate forum at college's main campus in Dearborn, Michigan, coinciding with worldwide student strikes and climate change awareness events. I spoke with one of the event organizers, Dr. Gary McElroy, English faculty.
So the first question that I was going to ask you was, how did the idea for a climate forum at HFC come about?
Well, this is a continuation was inspired by or motivated by what started in Europe mm-hmm. about a year ago. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard of her, but there's a girl, she was 15, mm-hmm. named Greta Thunberg from mm-hmm. Stockholm, Sweden.
Okay.
She herself, individually, with nobody else, mm-hmm. walked out and decided she was going to protest. Because mm-hmm. like all children, she went through a unit of science mm-hmm. and on the environment when she was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she heard about all these awful things, uh-huh. climate warming, and, you know, droughts, mm-hmm. and temperatures rising, mm-hmm. and crops failing. And she heard all this stuff at 8 years old, and she mm-hmm. wondered why it wasn't on the news every day.
Yeah.
Why it didn't fill the newspapers. Mm-hmm. Why... Mm-hmm. People weren't talking about it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a real dissonance in her head at
yeah.
that age.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
It just didn't seem to make sense.
Uh-huh.
And she discusses in many of her talks, and she's given tons mm-hmm. in this year, mm-hmm. including like TED Talks.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
She's spoken from the United Nations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool, okay.
That her so-called disabilities have actually helped her.
Mm-hmm.
She has Asperger's.
Oh, okay.
And she tends to see things in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And either climate is, either it's getting warmer
mm-hmm.
and becoming more, and Earth is becoming more uninhabitable, or it's
mm-hmm.
not.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that it is.
Yeah.
So why is nobody doing anything
yeah.
about it?
Yeah.
Well, at 8, she didn't, I guess, feel comfortable enough to do anything. She went into depression, stopped going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, when she was 15, she thought, I can do something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she wrote on a sign, strike for climate,
mm-hmm.
school strike for climate.
Mm-hmm.
She walked in front of the parliament
mm-hmm.
in Stockholm and sat there
mm-hmm.
holding up her sign.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, it attracted some interest.
Yeah.
And was this little girl sitting here? What's this all about?
Mm-hmm.
She gave her spiel. Attracted more attention, more
mm-hmm.
attention, more attention.
Mm-hmm.
Within a couple of months, it spread across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And other high school students were leaving their schools on Fridays at least, and
mm-hmm.
more days,
mm-hmm.
striking.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that... we've talked about this for 30 years now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Nothing has been done.
Yeah.
Emissions are still rising.
Mm-hmm.
CO2 emissions.
Mm-hmm.
My life is going to be such and such, according
mm-hmm.
to the scientists.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any more time.
Yeah.
We have to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And in March of this year and in May of this year, there were worldwide school strikes for
mm-hmm.
climate.
Mm-hmm.
And, simultaneously, there have been various movements, or I think growing out of her movement. There's a group called Extinction Rebellion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
And they have put a lot of pressure on Parliament.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., we have the Sunrise Movement
mm-hmm.
that was largely behind the Green New Deal
mm-hmm.
has been officially proposed
mm-hmm.
in Congress. So it inspired me. We have a fluid student base. Nobody
mm-hmm.
lives here.
Yeah.
So students couldn't take it on their own to come out here to
mm-hmm.
really strike. They just come to one class and then another class.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought we'd give it a little boost and
mm-hmm.
have a forum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And invite students
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
to come and hear some of the basic science,
mm-hmm.
to hear from political activists,
mm-hmm.
and give them a chance. We have some breakout sessions, so they have a chance to ask questions and be heard,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and perhaps join in some of these larger movements.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So it's about education and
okay.
An opportunity to get
mm-hmm.
further involved.
Mm-hmm. I like that it's not like geared toward any audience in particular, not that people that are going to specifically understand and are studying that topic.
Right.
It's nice that everybody will be able to go and kind of understand on a more
yeah.
basic level what's happening.
Right. It's really, this is where we are now.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've fiddled while Rome is burned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're, the United Nations scientists, really bright people
mm-hmm.
are saying
mm-hmm.
there's a tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. when the ice melts in the Arctic,
mm-hmm.
what's called the permafrost
mm-hmm.
is exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't been exposed for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And it's going to release all sorts of methane and
yeah.
other gases.
Yeah.
So things are in a loop.
Mm-hmm.
And when they reach a tipping point,
mm-hmm.
it's all but impossible to
yeah.
stop.
Right.
So we're probably at that tipping point right
yeah.
now.
Uh-huh.
United Nations says we have 12 years to cut emissions by 50%, which
mm-hmm.
would be a staggering achievement if
mm-hmm.
you could even do that.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Because we're still based on a fossil fuel economy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what people know, that's what they're comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of disinformation out there
yeah.
in the past 30 years. A
mm-hmm.
lot of people are speaking from mere self-interest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You and your company was big enough and had a lot of money, you'd hire your own advertisers
mm-hmm.
and hire even scientists
mm-hmm.
to do their own research, mm-hmm. quote unquote, and proclaim that really there was not much to this mm-hmm. climate change mm-hmm. stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah. if you can get supporters mm-hmm. and you can convince enough people, you can be yep. a politician to run on
it. Yep.
We have one in the White House.
Yep.
So the waters have been muddied.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And like anything, if you hear it too much, you just want to turn off. You just yeah. want to forget about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what these students are saying, this is our life.
Yeah.
You old yep. guys will be dead.
Yeah.
This is our life.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
One of my colleagues, which we'll be speaking to soon, mm-hmm. is about to have a grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
That grandchild will turn 80,
mm-hmm.
if everything goes well, at the turn of the century.
Yeah.
And the projections aren't good.
Yeah.
So what these students are saying, what scientists are saying,
mm-hmm.
what messengers like I am saying
mm-hmm.
is it's no more a matter, we're not trying to stop something.
Mm-hmm.
Things have been set in motion.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning with the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though the concept of greenhouse gases mm-hmm. was known then,
mm-hmm.
the disastrous consequences of them weren't widely understood
mm-hmm.
until the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we've done little
mm-hmm.
because of the lack of agreement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that if we don't act now, there may not be another moment.
Right.
When you can soften the blow.
Right, right, exactly. And it is interesting because there are, like you said, people that just have heard enough and just, like, turn it off, and then there are people that just, like, believe the false rhetoric, so then they, like, promote mm-hmm. that, like, way of thinking.
And it's not... I read one writer on this subject says it's probably the topic that we're least equipped
yeah.
to conceptualize.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm.
Because it's so vast, involves so many
right.
things.
Right. And there's so many different components to it.
It doesn't seem that drastic. Two
yeah.
degrees? We're
yeah.
going to warm up 2 degrees, great.
Right, right.
I don't like winter anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But to put that in perspective, and this should amaze anybody, whether you think the world, the earth as it exists,
mm-hmm.
having conditions just right for life,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
just right, just
yeah.
in that right temperature range,
mm-hmm.
which means there's just enough greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to trap enough heat
yeah.
to keep our toes warm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whether you believe that's God ordained,
mm-hmm.
or we just are one in a billion after that Big Bang,
mm-hmm.
that all of these things came together and all these elements perfect for life to form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then when human life came into existence to be nurtured in this very narrow band of climate,
mm-hmm.
for all of human existence,
mm-hmm.
back to, you know, the earliest people,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
before civilization,
mm-hmm.
this climate has been just within this narrow band.
Yeah.
And that includes the sustenance of things, animal life, plant life,
yeah.
sea life,
yeah.
that we need
mm.
to survive.
Yeah.
So while 2 degrees may not sound a lot
yeah.
to most people,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
it creates tremendous changes.
Yeah.
For one thing, that 2 degrees isn't going to be 2 degrees all over.
Yeah.
It's going to be hitting some people much harder and faster
yep.
than others.
Yep.
It leads to various high spikes in temperatures,
mm-hmm.
as we're
mm-hmm.
seeing all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
More and more intense hurricanes,
mm-hmm.
Droughts,
absolutely. Yeah.
Fires.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just now at about 1.1 degree warmer
yeah.
than we've been. It's that
yeah.
little change
mm-hmm.
in this delicate system
yep. Yep.
Is throwing everything off balance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the movie coming up, it's the last event of the day. It's a movie called The Human Element. The filmmaker, he shows us, you know, he goes around the world. He's a professional photographer, so mm-hmm. it's a gorgeous movie mm-hmm. of some horrific things.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Fire, flooding.
Uh-huh.
And, it's very human.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he calls it The Human Element.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the ancients used to believe in four elements, water, fire, earth, and air.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, I wish science had stopped there.
Yeah, yeah.
So these subatomic particles and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I could deal with that. And then he said, but the human element is affecting all four of those.
Yeah.
And we can affect it for the good or we can affect it for the bad.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes us around the world and shows how people are being affected. It's really engaging. But one of the things is he sends a helium balloon up with a camera.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And within 10 minutes, it's outside of our atmosphere.
Wow. Oh, okay.
And you see how thin that layer is.
Wow.
That sustains us. It's
so,
you know, everything else outside of that atmosphere doesn't have any oxygen in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very delicate balance.
Mm-hmm.
What it takes.
Mm-hmm. So what was your role specifically in organizing it here? Like, what about, or just the English department as a whole? Are they involved, or?
It was just when I thought we should do something. Because this is the date where there's strikes.
Yeah.
Observances mm-hmm. going on all around the world.
Mm-hmm. So okay.
So that date was selected, mm-hmm. September 20th.
Oh, all right.
And Greta herself says, if a bunch of school children can get this much attention,
mm-hmm.
how much attention would we get if the adults joined us?
Yeah,
too?
Okay.
So there are things happening all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Washtenaw County, where I live, there's, you know, climate strike. Students are walking out of high schools. I know they're doing it in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
They're doing it around here.
Mm-hmm.
So that day was set, and I just thought, what could we do? And we thought of some kind of rally at first,
mm-hmm.
or even a strike, but what are we striking against here?
Yeah.
A rally, we're going to get outside and shout. Shout
mm-hmm.
at whom for what?
Yeah.
So we thought more along the lines of education.
Mm-hmm.
And built into that are, you know, presentations on the basic science.
Mm-hmm.
And my remarks will be, where are we now?
Yeah.
What is going on in the world?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Temperature spikes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I sent out an email, and a number of people responded. We met in July,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
talked about the kinds of things
mm-hmm.
we could do.
Mm-hmm.
And we just slowly came up with
mm-hmm.
this forum idea.
Mm-hmm.
It was approved by administration.
Mm-hmm.
We're presenting it as an educational forum,
mm-hmm.
which it is.
Mm-hmm.
Then opportunities for students to meet with or join organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Sunrise and NextGen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his primary goal is climate.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, is there a specific goal that you have for the climate forum just as a whole?
The overriding goal is, of course, we hope students learn something
mm-hmm.
and are enriched by the experience,
mm-hmm.
but that they join in the breakout session.
Okay. Oh, okay.
That they feel compelled to give them,
mm-hmm.
give the organizers their address,
mm-hmm.
and
email,
mm-hmm. okay. and sort of bond in a way that they will come to another meeting, another
mm-hmm.
session, or
mm-hmm.
another action, a
mm-hmm.
strike, or something.
Mm-hmm.
That they,
okay.
it's you can't deal with it alone,
mm-hmm. right?
So we're trying to get people connected to some of these organizations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, students here have already formed a Sunrise Movement Hub.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have our own hubs.
Mm-hmm.
They can start taking members.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they went through a training,
mm-hmm.
a video training.
Mm-hmm.
And it really doesn't take much to get involved. You don't have to be Einstein.
Right, no. There are things all the time just online about how you can contact local senators or, like, just sign petitions.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. I mean, nobody really knows how valid they are, but of course it doesn't hurt.
Now, and I also will add that HFC for the last couple of years has been moving in a greener direction.
Yeah,
we
definitely.
We now have a standing committee, the
Cycling
Sustainable
Committee?
HFC. That's Erica's person to know.
Yep.
And they are coming up with ideas all the time.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
We have a president and VPs who are interested in moving in this direction. So it just came out of, you know, concern among staff and faculty. Some of us who were, in our comfortable abodes in July and met and have been sending emails back and forth.
Awesome.
Trying to figure out.
Awesome. Very nice. So it was like kind of grassroots then.
Yeah.
All right. That's very interesting. Cool. I like
mean,
the
word educational institute.
Yeah.
This is arguably the most important thing going on in the world.
Yes. Yes.
I feel that we owe it to our students.
Yes. Definitely.
To go over and above what might be done in the classroom. Say, let's look at it from the broadest perspective. This is what's happening in the world. This is where we all stand. What can be done? What can we do? What do you think?
Thank you. This was wonderful. I learned a lot. Thank you.
I also interviewed Henry Ford College biology instructor Linda Brandt, who organized a tree planting ceremony as one of the Climate Forum events.
Somebody pointed out to me the Plant a Trillion Trees campaign. And so we thought, ooh, we could do a Plant a Trillion Trees event as part of this. And so I said, I can take over that. I'll manage that. And I'll contribute the tree and go get it and figure out what kind to put in and dig the hole and all that.
Brandt continued to explain how the location for the tree was determined.
So here's the map. Here's Building D. So where we planted it, I believe, is this strip right here.
Oh, okay.
And that whole strip, except for a tree at the very end, that whole strip is empty. And
I noticed that today.
And it has an irrigation line down it.
Oh.
So we chose that strip on purpose. So that anybody else that wants to plant something can plant.
Oh,
that whole strip is clear.
Okay.
So we know there aren't gas lines or anything else there. Because, of course, that's part of what you have to take into consideration. Where are the gas lines? And where is the electricity? Even where is the irrigation system?
All right. That makes sense. One of the goals of the Climate Forum was to address misconceptions of climate science. Here is Professor Brandt.
We have stewardship of the Earth. And we, therefore, have a responsibility to do whatever we can. And years ago, decades ago, yes, I am that old. I've been teaching for a long time. And so decades ago, I would say to people, you know, if you're not sure if humans are contributing to global warming or not, the Earth is warming. And if it is going to make it unlivable, whether we are the cause or not, if there's something we can do about it, we should do it.
Exactly.
I didn't do it. But that doesn't mean it's not my problem.
Yeah.
We know that here's the basis. We humans have known since the 1800s that carbon dioxide warms the atmosphere when and that's why planet Earth is habitable, because we have this layer of carbon dioxide and water vapor, and now also methane, that acts as a blanket. It's actually a little more complicated than that, because there are chemical reactions that go on that also increase the heat. That is, so the infrared that's re-reflected to the Earth. But in many ways, it's like putting a blanket on at night. We've known since the 1800s that carbon dioxide does that. So that's a fact. Indisputable. We also know that when you take fossil fuels out of the ground, you're taking carbon from the ground, burning it, putting the carbon into the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide. That's indisputable. Where does anyone think that goes? It goes into the atmosphere and into the water. And it doesn't escape, because we have this layer. It doesn't just escape into space. We have gravity. It holds it in. And so given those two things, the temperature of the Earth is going to go up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just had, in fact, someone who was very supportive of the whole, in fact, he helped dig in the hole for the tree.
Mm-hmm.
No, actually, he didn't, but he's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's supportive of doing everything we can to fight climate change. He said, but isn't part of this just part of the natural cycle anyway? I said, well, there is a natural cycle. But the natural cycle is that because of the Earth's tilt, the Earth, you know, has gone through small ice ages,
mm-hmm.
and then it warms, mm-hmm. maybe 20,000 years or so. You know, there are these slight fluctuations.
Mm-hmm.
But we were entering a cooling.
Yeah.
So if this were part of the natural cycle, we would be cooling.
Yeah. Yeah. Brandt also shared her approach to teaching climate change in her biology classes. Is there a curriculum, or is climate change covered in biology classes? Is it a requirement, or do teachers like just talk about it on their own? Or
I teach biology 150.
Mm-hmm.
The first unit, so the first quarter mm-hmm. of the course,
mm-hmm.
I used to always call ecology.
Mm-hmm.
Now I call it ecology and sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Sustainability is really the application of ecology. Environmental mm-hmm. science is the mm-hmm. applications of ecology and other areas.
Mm-hmm.
So I talk about it in that unit.
Okay.
It seems to come up almost every class period.
Right, right. Which is what I would assume.
From one aspect or another.
Right, right.
It comes up. If we're talking about invasive plants, mm-hmm. it comes up because mm-hmm. invasives thrive in mm-hmm. warmer weather mm-hmm. oftentimes.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're talking about the carbon cycle,
mm-hmm.
it comes up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So yes, we talk about it in there.
Mm-hmm.
Environmental science, 138 and 139, of course.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about it there.
Okay, okay.
I know that Bio 131 has a couple labs
mm-hmm.
where they talk about ecology.
Okay.
How much, I don't teach that course,
mm-hmm.
how much they go into climate change, global warming, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I know we do in 150, 138, 139.
Okay. But it's not a requirement. It's just like from teacher to teacher, they can decide how much like
correct.
To talk about it. Okay. That was Dr. Linda Brandt, Henry Ford College biology instructor. This has been Olivia Grantham reporting for the Mirror News.
Thank you, Olivia. We now turn to Phoenix Vlasin, who interviewed motivational speaker Anthony Iani.
This is Phoenix Vlasin. I am speaking to Anthony Iani, speaker for the Relentless Tour, which is currently touring at our Henry Ford Community College campus. How are you?
Good. How about yourself?
Great. So you were a former basketball player with Michigan State, very well known in your time.
Yep.
And you, after getting out of college, you started doing a lot of speaking engagements
mm-hmm.
Related to, you know, first of all, I believe related to the Autism Alliance Network and related to autism in particular.
Yep.
And then sort of targeted that more, as I understand, towards bullying in schools with mm-hmm. children, slightly older children, and even toward college level. Now, just for our readers, that's more of a summary, but yeah. I can't explain the details better than you can. So I'd like to start at the beginning of, you know, you started speaking specifically with autism, and you
yep.
disclosed that you are on the autism spectrum. So how did that come about? What's the earliest you can remember with that?
As far as when I started speaking, or...
As far as, just to clarify, as far as your experience with autism itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was diagnosed with PDD-NOS, which stands for Pervasive Developmental Disorder, when I was four, and it's an autism spectrum disorder. And what's really unique about my diagnosis is that was in 1993, when a day and age when nobody really knew what autism was, nobody knew a lot of the characteristics for it, no awareness for it, and during that time period, it was more the, you know, diagnosis for ADD and ADHD. So my diagnosis was very rare. And then a year later, when I was 5 years old, a group of doctors and experts told my family that because I was on the autism spectrum, they told my family to don't expect much or see me do much in life. They told my family I was barely going to graduate from high school, not go to college, never be an athlete, end up in a group institution whenever I got done with high school. So that was the connection for me. You know, that's where it all started for me with autism and my diagnosis. And so my parents didn't tell me that that story about what those individuals said about me till I was a freshman in high school. So that was kind of like my motivation to kind of go out and, you know, just prove the world wrong, you know, prove those doctors and experts wrong, that just because I have autism doesn't mean I can't do all these great things.
Right, exactly. Because it seems like, you know, they're just evaluating a boy and then suddenly saying, well, he's not going to go on to do much in life, which, you know, to most of us, you know, that seems wildly unfair.
Well, right. And that was the reaction I had too, Phoenix, with when my parents told me that, because they just brought me in our living room in our house and just laid it all down for me. And the only thing that was going through my mind was, who says this about a 5 year old?
Like I
was still at, I just started kindergarten. I was at the age where I was still developing my numbers and all that other stuff. And like, you know, cause I was like, how can you tell when what somebody's future is 13 years from now,
right?
You know, at five, like,
right.
I mean, you can't do that. And
yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, that was the thing that just got me going. And that really motivated me to just not just go prove those individuals wrong, but to prove every single doubter, bully, and person who ever disrespected me in my life, just to go out and just show them that I can do this and I will
right.
do this despite what you're telling
exactly.
me.
Exactly, because as far as we know about autism now, it's a spectrum of
yep.
different symptoms. There are some people who may, you know, require home assistance, who may
yep.
require assisted living, but then
mm-hmm.
there are also people who don't require that and can do much more
right.
than they're given credit for.
And that's, yeah, and there's that old saying too, like, once you met a person with autism, you've met a person with autism.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, you mentioned the spectrum is so massive itself, because you're going to meet a bunch of people like myself that are really high functioning, and you're going to meet folks that are low end of the spectrum and then right smack dab in the middle. And but the one thing that I get criticized a lot for is, you know, people will look at me whenever I go and present at colleges, schools, or conferences, wherever, and they'll just look at me and go, no, no, there's just no way. Like, he had to be misdiagnosed.
Oh, yeah, no, I...
Right? You know where I'm going with this.
I know what you mean. I mean, I'll reveal why later in our conversation, because I'm trying to make this mainly about you, but I do know from personal experience what
right.
you mean.
Because, like, I've always told those folks, like, you know what? You see me in my profession as
right.
a speaker.
Exactly.
You know, hang out with me in my house for 2 hours. Hang around me and my wife and see, you know, I see some of the sarcasm and jokes and pieces that I can't catch really well.
Exactly.
And
I've always
said to people, like, have breakfast, lunch, dinner, or coffee or drink with me, and we'll have a good conversation for 2 hours, and you'll walk away from that conversation having a better understanding of who I am.
Right.
Because a lot of people just look at autism as a label,
yeah.
as a stat.
Yeah.
And it's my job to make sure that I go out and show society that, you know what, we're not just labels. We're
exactly.
not just stats. And if you think we are just labels, well, guess what? You might be right, because everybody in life has a label. I mean, you're a student here. I mean, that's a label. A Henry Ford Community College label, right? Stamped. And so I'm a husband, father, motivational speaker, Michigan State Spartan, former college basketball player, autism spectrum. Pretty proud to say all those things.
Right, of course. So, going off of one of your earlier points, you said you had that sort of talk with your parents and that realization
mm-hmm.
when you were 14. And that, you know, through my research, coincided with when you started your basketball career. So
mm-hmm.
were there earlier influences in your life with basketball? Because I do know from a bit of research that your parents were very heavily involved
yep.
in Michigan State sports. So was that your main influence with going into sports, or was there something deeper?
So, you know, I was involved with basketball, you know, kind of way before, you know, my parents told me about that story when I was 14. I was in Little Leagues, you know, I played baseball, Little League baseball, I played flag football and tackle football in middle school. But, you know, both my parents were athletes in college. You know, my dad played baseball at Michigan State, and my mom was a 3-time All-American Adrian College.
Wow.
And she still holds, like, it's like 7 or 8 records, the school's all-time leading score in both men and women's basketball, has her jersey retired. So she's a legend at Adrian Lee. She is. And so just seeing what my parents were able to accomplish in college and seeing what my mom did and just watching all these great pro players back in the 90s, like Magic, like Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, you know, Allen Iverson early in his career, Kobe Bryant in his career, and Shaq. Like, I wanted to be like those guys. And, you know, my father, you know, he's now retired. You know, he worked at Michigan State Athletics for over 26 years. But I got to be around all those great teams, around all those Final Four teams, around a national championship team. I was around Coach Izzo since I was a little kid. And I knew from day one when my dad started working at Michigan State that this is where I wanted to be at. This is where I wanted to go. This is the fight song I want to sing every time I walk out of the arena. Like, you know, this is the jersey I want to wear with pride every time I walk out of that tunnel. So it was just something that was always a dream of mine. Like, I didn't want to go to any other school. Like, Michigan State was where I wanted to be.
Oh, it's great to have that commitment. So how did you go from the high school level to then going to play at a much wider level of college basketball?
So I was recruited in high school by, you know, teams of all levels. I was recruited by, early on, I was recruited by Michigan State, Michigan, Notre Dame, Wisconsin, Purdue, Iowa, Valparaiso, Indiana, Purdue, Fort Wayne. So I was recruited, you know, by a lot of teams when I was in high school. And, you know, when I got down to it, it was Michigan State, Oakland University, or Grand Valley State. And, you know, Oakland had initially offered me going into my junior year of high school. They were my first ever offer. And so, you know, my point guard who I played with in high school, he had committed there after my junior season. And I was always teasing the idea to people that, you know, maybe I'll go to Oakland and reunite with him and we'll finish what we started, you know, at Oakland High School together. And, you know, my scholarship got pulled from them. They gave it to another kid. You know, it is what it is. That's just the game of recruiting. You know, it is what it is. So it was Grand Valley State, Michigan State. And, you know, Grand Valley State threw a full ride offer on the table.
Wow.
Coach Izzo offered me to be a walk-on. So I was really caught with a tough decision. And so I actually had a conversation with him before I decided what I was going to do. And it was like a day after I had my official visit at Grand Valley State. It was fantastic. I loved the campus, loved the people.
I was there myself like years and years ago. It's really great.
Allendale's a great place. And I tell people that, you know, even though I was there for 2 years, I still hold a special place in my heart for it because they gave me my opportunity. And when I had the conversation with Coach Izzo of what do I do, he just looked at me like I was crazy, saying, like, okay, you got a full ride offer on the table. We offered you a walk-on position, so here's what you can do. You can turn down that full ride offer, come here, play at your dream school, try to earn a scholarship down the road. It could take you a couple of years to earn. Or you can go to Grand Valley State and get everything paid for. School, tuition, room, food, all that stuff. You don't have to worry about a thing. He said, if you don't take a full ride offer, you know, I'm gonna throw you out of this building myself, and you're gonna be one of my players. So that's when I knew that he wanted what was best for me. Yeah. As much as he wanted me to be at Michigan State, as much as I wanted to be there, he knew at the end of the day that a full ride offer, you know, was the best for me. And that's what I did. So I committed to Grand Valley State. Was there for 2 years. I had 2 great years there. You know, my freshman year, our basketball team was 36-1. You know, we were the first ever state of Michigan college team to go undefeated in a regular season. So it was just, my first 2 years were great. But, you know, going into my second year, things were really up and down for me. And I decided I needed to make a change and go to a place where I was going to be happy for the rest of my college career. And there was no hesitation. It was Michigan State. I mean, because even when I was at Grand Valley State, Phoenix, I always rooted for Michigan State. You know, I always rooted for the football team. I rooted hard for the basketball team. And all my teammates at Grand Valley State were like, you know, you're a Laker. Like, why are you cheering for Michigan State? I said, well, because I'm from there. And two, those are my guys. Like, I'm always going to root for them. And, you know, Grand Valley State had a Go Blue chant. I never did it. Because Michigan State.
Yeah, so, I was going to say.
Yeah, so even my teammates at Grand Valley State were like, it's okay. I'm like, no, it's not. Like, you have no idea. It's not okay. So,
no, I understand.
But, you know, but to go from, you know, where I was in high school to competitive ball, not just at Division II, but the Division I level, it was definitely a big change for me. But, like, because I was around Michigan State for so many years and I was around Coach Izzo for so long, like, I kind of knew and expected what I was walking into at that point. But it was definitely a lot more hard work than before, and a lot more time, you know, being put in when it came to both academically and basketball as well.
Right, yeah, because I mean, ultimately, like, going into Michigan State, you get thrown on the national level.
Yep.
Yeah, and, yep. That, and then that's something you have to sort of deal with as far as, like, press coverage.
Oh, yeah, you know? Yeah. And, like, I basically lived in a hole when I was at Michigan State because, you know, I didn't go to any of the bars. I didn't go out at all because I didn't want to be that one guy who ended up on ESPN's bottom line ticker for doing stupid stuff. Because, you know, when I was at Grand Valley State, you know, we were on a certain schedule. You know, we had – if we were in season, we had practice Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, game Thursday, walkthrough Friday, game Saturday, off on Sunday. So that was our schedule routine. And so – but, like, I went out – I tell people all the time, like, my best years socially in college were at Grand Valley State because, you know, I mean, you've been to Allen. Everything's, like, right there.
Yeah.
Everything's within
yeah.
walking distance. So if somebody was having a get-together at their apartment, you can walk down the street 5 minutes and be there.
Right.
And so where Michigan State is so spread out, but like you said, Grand Valley State is not – it's a Division II school. It's not on the national level like a Michigan State is.
Right.
So when I went to Michigan State, you know, I knew a lot of my buddies I went to high school with and teammates I played in high school with went there. So if I was going to go hang out with somebody, I'd go hang out with them because those were the guys I kind of trusted most. But anybody else outside of that, I was like, nah, I'm just going to go in my hole for a little while and just – and then it, and once the season started, like – you were locked. I had to be locked in. Like, our whole team was locked in the whole time because we had a job to do. We had goals as a team and then as individuals as well. So, but, you know, it's a different level when you – it's a different animal, I should say, when you play at a top-tier program like Michigan State on a national standpoint because now all eyes are on you. Mm-hmm. Like, people want to see you screw up, which is why I didn't go – I barely went out because it's like, all right – this person doesn't like probably doesn't like me. This person over here may disrespect me. So I'm just going to stay back. And then when I'm done here in Michigan State, I will go out with my buddies on the football team, have a good time, which is what I did because I kind of had to earn a lot of respect from some fans, you know, because a lot of them thought I didn't belong there because of my ties with Michigan State, because of my father being in the athletic department there. So, you know, Coach Izzo had a, you know, pretty good story. He talked to people about how I came to Michigan State as Greg Iannone's son, but then I left Michigan State just as Anthony Iannone. So I had to earn all that. And then that's when, like, you know, I was like, all right, you know what? I kind of got a lesson in earning people's respect, but at the same time, you know, trying to be careful with looking out for yourself as well, especially on that big of a stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Another article that I had read, and this was sort of back a ways when you were still playing,
mm-hmm.
I think you had mentioned at one time to a reporter that you were thinking of perhaps going into an athletic field after college.
Yep.
And what ended up happening was now this lecture series and this further work with autism. So mm-hmm. how did that come about?
So long story short, our former lieutenant governor, Brian Kelly, you know, Brian is, in my opinion, maybe one of the biggest advocates for autism in the state of Michigan. At the time, you know, after that, I think it was the MLive.com article that you may be referring to.
Yes, that was it.
Yeah,
was
so,
it
exactly. So that was like the first ever article, first ever time my story went public. And so nobody knew about it until when Diamond Lee Young wrote that article. And Diamond did a great job with it. And so Brian Kelly spoke at our basketball banquet like 2 days after that article came out. And so 2 days after the banquet, my parents get a phone call from his office saying, hey, you know, the Autism Alliance of Michigan has their gala coming up in Detroit on April 20th. You know, would Anthony like to be the keynote speaker at it? And my parents asked me, I was like, well, just let me get through the season first, and then I'll think about it and go from there. Season was over. I didn't even hesitate. I called Brian's office. I said, I'm in. I'll do it. And then that's when I did my first – it was like my first ever speech I gave. You know, I don't even count like classroom presentations. I don't count that. But like when it came to like an actual speech of in itself – that was the first time I ever did it. And it was like a 9-10 minute speech. I got a standing ovation to it. I got a great reaction to it. And Frank Beckman, who from WJR 760, you know, he did a 1-on-1 Q&A with me on the stage after that. And we had a lot of fun doing it. But that's when I knew that I had an idea of what I was going to do. And I was driving my wife home that night and I told her, I said, I think I know where I'm meant to be now. And she said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, I said, other than Dr. Temple Grandin, who's maybe one of the most famous individuals in the world with autism, an individual who I consider a mentor that I've met a bunch of times before and talked to before, I said, name me somebody else other than her who's like a big role model, a big inspiration, a big icon for the autism community. I said, besides her, name me somebody else. My wife sat there in silence because she couldn't think of anybody. And that's why I looked her in the eyes. I said, all right, I'm going to go be that guy then. I'm going to be that guy to be that hero, inspiration, role model, icon for that community. Because, you know, I've always told people, like, I love Temple. I really do. She's not going to be around forever, though. So somebody kind of has to step up to that plate and go be, you know, I wouldn't say really fill her shoes because, you know, she's done so much. That's a lot of filling up to do. But, you know, as far as, like, continuing the great work that she is doing and for somebody to look, or for an individual to be looked up to like she did, that's what I want to do. And that's why I started doing all this. And then 2 months after that speech, Autism Alliance of Michigan hired me. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years after that, you know, I'm with Department of Civil Rights doing all this now.
So the Relentless Tour, it's through the department.
Yes.
But it's also like your project that you decided, this is what I want to do.
Yep.
So how did it transition from Autism Alliance to this?
So I started it in October 2013 with Autism Alliance. It actually almost didn't get off the ground because there were a lot of people that I'm not going to name who were within the organization that just said, well, you know, it's going to cost us a lot. Like, you know, maybe now's not the time, you know, wait another year for it. And I was like, no, you know what? I'm not going to wait. Like, I'm not going to do that. Like, if you don't believe in this thing, then just get off the train right now, you know, because it's going with or without you. And so, so I launched it regardless. And so the initial idea around it was to visit 657 middle schools. That's how many middle schools we have in Michigan. To visit all 657 middle schools in the state of Michigan in 1 year. And then once I launched it, I got bombarded with phone calls from high schools, elementary schools, private schools, prep schools, charter schools. And then that's when I was like, all right, you know what? Don't do just middle schools, like, do everybody, because it's bigger than just middle schools. And so that's what we did. And like the first year we did it, it was so popular that, you know, the next year we started filling up. And then, you know, Brian Calley, you know, called me up and said, hey, I'm just letting you know that there are a couple of our state departments who are really closely watching this. And because I had a connection with civil rights, because my scheduler at the time, she was helping out because she worked for civil rights and she knew a lot of school connections around the state and in the upper part of the state. So she really helped and pitched out a lot. So I think she was putting in a good word because at the time, civil rights had a bullying initiative that really kind of that really flopped. And so they were looking for somebody to kind of head up that part of their department. And so, you know, Brian said to me, he said, I'm just letting you know, you may get a phone call from one of these two departments down the road. And he said, just keep doing what you're doing. And then October came around 2014, and Matt, we saw the director at the time, said, hey, how would you feel if I brought you on? I said, if I hired you. I said, I would love nothing more, man. I said, that'd be great. And so they hired me March 1st. I started with them on March 1st of 2015, and I walked into Matt's office the first day, and I sat down, and he looked at me in my eyes and said, all right, yours. So what are you talking about? He said, the Relentless Tour, like, it's all yours. Like, you do whatever the heck you want with it. From a brand standpoint, you know, from an initiative standpoint, from a messaging standpoint, you want to take it out of state, go ahead. I don't care. But just make sure I get approval on everything before you run off with it. And I was like, all right, you got it. And so, you know, Matt kind of, because I felt like when I was at Autism Alliance, I really felt like I was being held down a little bit, you know, because I felt like I was doing a lot of promoting on my own, a lot of outreach on my own, and I really wasn't getting a lot of the support and the help that I needed for this initiative to be successful. And like I said, it was popular the first year, and its popularity was still catching on and staying steady. But like, as far as like getting like media attention and like, you know, promoting it, like I was doing it on my own. And so, you know, I was really frustrated with that. But then, I mean, when I go in my first day on the job and my boss just says to me, here are the keys, just rock it, just roll with it, do what you want with it, just, but as long as I get approval, you know, we're good. But, you know, for them to believe in me from day one doing this, I was like, all right, I'm with a group that supports this thing, that's going to help me and help me get the right resources and directions that I need to be successful. And so that's where I'm at. And for civil rights to take this thing on, and for us as a department to say that we have one of the best anti-bullying initiatives initiatives, not just in the state of Michigan, but maybe the country. That just shows right there that not only is our department taking that leadership into being the leaders of anti-bullying, but it's also meaning that the state of Michigan itself is continuing to be the leaders for anti-bullying around the country as well.
Right. So one of the things I wanted to address, just sort of more with you personally about this, and this is sort of drawing on my own experience a little bit, because I've dealt with sort of mental, this sort of unknown mental thing for a very long time, and I the first time I met one of my little cousins on my youngest aunt's side, I noticed that he had a lot of behaviors that mirrored the way I behaved in childhood, and then it was disclosed to me that he had autism.
Right.
So I thought, okay, that's not a given, but there might be a possibility that I have this. So when I got to Michigan, when I sort of settled in Michigan, I did try to get testing just to see if there was any possibility it might be on the spectrum.
Right.
I ultimately was not. There were just other overlapping conditions that explained the symptoms. But the process going through even to get testing and to get heard was incredibly eye-opening for people who, you know, are on the spectrum. As far as, you know, finding places that, first of all, did adult testing, that was fairly difficult. And then when I spoke to the evaluator afterwards, even though he didn't... he ultimately concluded I didn't have autism based on not meeting enough criteria. What he did say was, there are, you know, some people on the spectrum that I evaluate, and a lot of the time it is something that they have to be careful about when seeking medical help, because a lot of people will assume like they're lower on the spectrum, even though they're, you know, advocating for themselves and they're getting their own medical care. So, I mean, this was not fairly recently, a little while ago, but this was something that I experienced, and I wasn't even ultimately on the spectrum. It made me sort of a lot very sympathetic for what autistic people do have to go through when they get further treatment after evaluation.
Right.
So basically what I wanted to ask was, you know, with your experience with, you know, with doctors, with medical staff, or even with, you know, advocacy groups, how have you seen things evolve and change, and has it been for the better?
I mean, obviously the first step was, you know, getting our autism legislation bill passed, and Brian did that in April 2012, you know, making sure that insurance companies offers ABA and, you know, CBA therapies and treatments for those on the spectrum. And at the time, we were basically one of the only states in the state of Michigan that didn't have, or basically one of the only states in the country that didn't have it, amongst others. Then we got on board with it, and then Virginia got on board with it, then Ohio got on board with it, and then Tennessee. Like, basically almost every state in the country has that same legislation that we do, making sure that, you know, all insurance companies are covering treatments and therapy sessions for individuals who are affected, or families who are affected on the autism spectrum. And so I could definitely see it's definitely gotten better in a lot of ways. As far as awareness, though, you know, we still got a lot of work to do. We still got a lot of work in, you know, basically showing society, you know, what these individuals can do. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, society just looks at the word autism and just like, oh, well, these people got to be helped for the rest of their lives. They're not going to be much. And so I kind of made it my job to make sure I look at society in the face and go, no, no, no. Like, just because this individual's on the low end of the spectrum doesn't mean that they're capable of something. Doesn't mean that they don't have talented traits, you know. And, you know, Coach Izzo and I had a conversation about this 7 years ago. His next door neighbor, or one of his neighbors, has a son with low functioning autism, but he's a fantastic painter, and like, he'll have to be helped, you know, cared for the rest of his life, but he's a fantastic painter, and all his paintings have been hung up in the East Lansing Art Museum every year. And I told Coach Izzo, I said, Coach, that's the thing. Like, people never give us a chance, you know, and it's time for society to kind of realize that, you know what, there are a lot of individuals with autism, not just, you know, athletes. You know, I've met two basketball players in the last year. You know, one of them just signed a letter of intent to play basketball this year at Kent State University, Kalen Bennett. He's the first ever autistic athlete to sign a letter of intent to play Division I college basketball. You know, I signed to play Division II, so big difference there. You know, I was the first to play it, and then he followed in my footsteps. And then I met another kid, Jordan Schwalger, who's from Australia. You know, he's only in his third year of playing basketball, but now he's playing at Prolific Prep Academy in California. He's a Division I recruit for basketball. And he kind of I kind of took him under my wing because his mom reached out to me saying, you know, my son's playing basketball, you know, what can he do? And what did you do? And so I'm not just seeing from an athlete standpoint, but I'm seeing from individuals who are incredible at math, incredible at science, incredible at music. Cody Lee, you know, America's Got Talent, prime example of that. And so anytime I see these individuals doing great things, you know, I said it like in a statement, you know, not long ago. I said it's time for society to kind of wake up and realize that, you know, we're not just sitting around at home doing nothing.
Absolutely.
You know, we're not feeling sorry for ourselves. You know, just because we have autism, we're not sitting back and going, you know, why, woe is me. We're getting up out of those seats every day, getting out of our houses and getting after it. Because I've told people that, you know, Apple, Google, GM, Ford, like, they're hiring individuals with autism, you know, because they're so smart at what they do, you know, especially Apple. And I've told people, I said, you watch. I said, you know, if Apple needs a new CEO and owner one day, I said, you watch. A person with autism is going to run that company in 10 years from now. And then don't sit there and come back to me and say, well, you still can't do this. It's like, all right, cool. Then watch us run Ford.
Right.
Watch us run Little Caesars. Watch us run a professional sports team. Like, you know, that's the thing. Like, we're coming for your job, pretty much. We're coming for you. So, and until society starts realizing that, you know, they're just going to keep getting embarrassed every time because we're going to go out and just continue to prove everybody wrong and continue to prove that we are bigger than autism.
Yeah, absolutely. No, even though I didn't end up being on the autism spectrum, that experience and just my experience being with my cousin who does have autism just opened my eyes so much to it. It wasn't like they were super close tight before, but it just gave me more experience into what it was.
Like, I mean, you get it. Like, you understand it.
No, so when earlier you were talking about how, you know, people would look at you and say, oh, well, he doesn't really have autism because he can do this, and it just seems professional.
Right.
Like, when I was early on, I told only, like, a couple of people in my family about that I was, you know, seeking evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And at least one of those people said, well, you know, that's not something you probably have, you know, because you're independent, you're helpful. So even though I don't have that condition, I understand in that sense how frustrating it is. And for the record, the other person I told was my aunt whose son is autistic. And what I love is she's never held him back from anything. She's never sold him short. She's gotten, you know, help from him for school, for things that he needs, but she never sees him as less of anything, and neither do I.
Right.
It's very.
And I have my sister, so I have three nieces. My sister has three daughters. You know, my oldest niece, Gia, who's four, the same age as my oldest son, Knox. And then her twins are two. You know, they were born in July, but they're almost the same age as my youngest son, Nash, who's two. Or who's one, actually. So both my twin nieces were diagnosed last winter. And so, you know, when my mom told me that, it was one of those moments where it really hit you, because it's like, you know, dang, like, you know, who would have thought? But at the same time, I'm like, well, guess what? You know, they got grandparents who live with this for almost 30 years. And I know people who work in the ABA and CBA fields, who have worked in the therapy fields for autism, who know all this stuff. And I started calling people and say, hey, my niece just got diagnosed. Like, so, but what I'm seeing with my sister is, like, you know, kind of the same deal. She ain't holding them back.
Right.
They're going to therapy. They're doing incredible work, and they're getting better every day.
Yeah.
And so that's why I was like, all right, you know what? It hit us at first because we were just like a little shell shocked by it.
Right.
But then once we were like, oh, you know what? We've been here. We've done all that. Let's get them the services that they need to do better.
Yeah.
And so one of my nieces is basically just talking up a storm. The other one's still a little behind, but she's getting better. You know, she's farther along than where she was like 6 months ago. And so, but again, that's a testament to what our state legislators did at that time. Mm-hmm. Because if that bill's not passed, then how are we going to get those treatments and ABA therapies that those individuals need?
Yeah. No, I'm aware of time.
No, you're good.
We're getting close to the wire. I just wanted to end on more just sort of more of a positive note.
For sure,
from what I've seen with autism and with what I've seen also just from videos that I've seen on you with this tour, interacting with children.
Yeah.
It always comes away just like how much of an effect you have on them, seeing someone not only talk about just autism for kids who may be autistic and don't have any other person in their lives with that, mm-hmm. but just kids in general when they see someone, you know, speaking out about bullying in general and the end problems they may be facing and just how that's affected them in terms of how they see other children, how they see, you know, themselves. They walk away with more confidence in themselves, even if they are still dealing with that.
Exactly. And that's probably one of the favorite parts about what I do as a speaker is that, you know, is interacting with these kids. And, you know, early on, I have the goal of, you know, if you don't make at least one person cry, you're not doing your job. And then the more and more I started doing this, I said, all right, you know what, put that to, you know, table that. You know, it should be about inspiring at least one person. That's when I came up with the approach of, so everywhere I go, my approach is, you know, walk in the building, inspire at least one person, and your job is done. Because that's all it takes in life. It's just inspiring one person, and that next person will carry on your message. And so, but for me to meet these kids, interact with them, hear their stories, and what they've overcome, and what they're continuing to go through, and then for me to look at them, and them to look at me and say, you're the reason why I know that there's more beyond tomorrow, that there's more 10 years from now for me, you know, because of what you went through. That really hits home to me because it's like I'm doing my job. I'm hitting home with these guys. And because I want them to know that they are not alone. Like, I've been in your shoes before. I've been there. I've done that. Because a lot of these kids, I'm not, like, I'm only 30 years old, but, like, a lot of these kids that are in high school, I'm only 13 years older than they are. You know, which is crazy because, like, you know, I've seen a lot of other anti-bullying presenters who are in their 40s or in their 50s. And I'm just like, I said, well, the difference between me and them is that I can connect with these kids right now because, number one, I got the Michigan State label. You know, that's obviously a big thing, big deal here in the state.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as the age difference, I'm not that far off from them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm almost in the same pool as them when it comes to the generation,
yeah.
You know, the same generation. So, you know, but whenever I get to interact with these guys, like, and just seeing what they go through and how they know there's hope, you know, beyond tomorrow, like, it really inspires me. And, like, the messages and the notes and the Facebook, Instagram notes I get from people, you know, that's what really keeps me going every day. No matter what time in the morning I get up and I'm on the road, no matter if I'm on an airplane heading out of state somewhere to go speak, like, those guys are the reason why, you know, I do what I do. That and the 3.5 million people in our country with autism, you know, they are the reason why I do what I do every day.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much
for this interview. It's been really, it really has been eye-opening. And I'm going to stick around for your talk.
That was Phoenix Vlasin interviewing Anthony Iani. For resources on anti-bullying and autism and more information on Anthony Iani and his future speaking engagements, go to relentlesstour.com. This is Fatima Nkata for the Mirror News.
That wraps up today's Mirror News edition of the WHFR Journal. We'll be back with more next week here at 1 o'clock on your Friday afternoon. Stay tuned. Kitty Love up next, taking us a trip down Highway 61 here on WHFR, making waves.
Attention, crafters and record enthusiasts. WHFR is hosting our very first Rock and Roll Craft Bazaar, which is taking place alongside our 12th annual record show on October 19th. For over a decade, the record show has been a great source for hard-to-find music and memorabilia. And now you can also find one-of-a-kind handmade items by local artists all under one roof. Please visit whfr.fm for more details. We hope to see you at WHFR's Rock and Roll Craft Bazaar and Record Show on Saturday, October 19th.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.